joining us now on the phone with a Soggy Trails report, Charlie from Mountain Trails Foundation. Good morning.
Leslie, there's no question. It is the Soggy Trail Report. So I guess my suggestion would be, I think it's pretty obvious we don't have to talk too much about mud this morning, but, you know, think about the alternatives. I think skiing in Bonanza Flat would be exceptional. So that's my pitch. And, of course, people keep saying Snowbird is unbelievable, and we keep getting snow. So maybe it's time to break the skis back out.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier, I saw Haney walking down the street. He had his boots and skis on his back. He was headed down to the bus stop. He was headed somewhere.
Yeah, quite honestly, I've skied up in the Bonanza Flat, backside of, kind of the Juniper Peak Ridge area this time of year, and it's great. And, go over and hike up Alta and things like that. But otherwise, yeah, I think if you want to find good biking or less soggy trail conditions, the only place that really looked good in the weather world was, Moab was kind of coming back from some rain, but the St. George area, Hurricane, that kind of I-15 corridor actually looked better than probably most places. So without belaboring it, hopefully we'll dry out this next week. We will be having National Trails Day is actually, I guess, two weekends away at this point. And we have an exciting project that will be over on Treasure Hill at that point. So if you get a chance and want to turn out and do a little bit of service work on trails in your local community, that opportunity is, we have the details in our newsletter, and you can certainly find out about it. It'll be out there on Facebook and stuff as well. So join us for that.
Okay, real quick.
Leslie, have a great weekend.
Hey, before you go, the Snuttville Basin Water Reclamation District is going to be doing a big project there along Kearns Boulevard, basically taking place between Comstock and Richardson Flat Road. There along the rail trail corridor, any idea whether or not that will be impacted by this construction?
I don't know, and I will try to find out for you so that we do know. The rail trail is not a mountain trails deal anymore. So I haven't really kind of kept an eye on that ball. But, hopefully not. The rail trail's had enough impacts from construction and whatnot in the last couple of years. It'd be nice to just have it be a ride through these days. So hopefully there won't be a huge impact.
Okay, Charlie, thanks.
You bet, Leslie. Bye.
What started as 100 rooms in a luxury hotel at reduced rates for our servicemen and women has blown up to more than 2,300 acres of land in Wasatch County, basically becoming its own small community, decided with land use decisions being decided by an appointed board of directors who meet monthly at the MIDA offices in Kaysville. On the phone to tell us what happened and why this is happening, I've got the manager of Wasatch County, Mike Davis. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, we had heard that was just going to be a small 40-acre development parcel of MIDA kind of into a 100-room hotel has now basically become this entire Jordanelle Basin area now being controlled by MIDA. Can you tell us what happened?
You bet. It's a little bit different than that, but let me explain. The MIDA project area has always been approximately 2,500 acres or thereabouts, but the control area that they would actually control was only going to be the hotel, and that has expanded significantly to essentially all of the property west of Highway 40 to the Park City Summit County line on the west side. And so it did expand. We weren't necessarily favorable to that. There was, once we had agreed to the project area with MIDA, the state stepped in and somewhat forced our hand a little bit to allow MIDA itself to be the land use authority on everything west of the highway. The county continues to be the land use authority east of the highway. And so it wasn't the scenario we had hoped for, but we do have still in place quite a bit of control over things. The densities are set as they were even back when it was first established around 2016 when we first signed the agreement. So the densities aren't increasing, but the land use controls are changing.
I spoke yesterday with the chairman of Extel Development Company, Gary Barnett. It's a recorded interview that I'll be airing next week. He told me it was Wasatch County's idea to give MIDA control of the Mayflower Mountain development. Is that accurate?
Well, originally back in 2016, we had agreed to give MIDA control of the hotel site. But it has been different now since then, that it's been expanded to control to include the whole west side. So I'm not sure if he's understanding the question correctly or if it's being misstated, but they will have control, and it certainly was not Wasatch County's idea. We did agree to it, and we agreed to a modification of an existing memorandum of understanding with MIDA, and so, yeah, it wasn't our idea.
Well, you had mentioned last week at the county council meeting that Wasatch County has not signed this memorandum of understanding. Is this with MIDA or is this with Mayflower? And what does the MOU do?
This will be an operational memorandum. We'll have several memorandum of understandings. This will be an operational one, which will define how permits are handled through the system. In the MIDA control area, which is the area to the west of the highway, all the permitting goes through MIDA, but it is coming back to the county to actually administer. And so the county is going to be administering all permits in the area, but we need a memorandum of understanding completed with MIDA so that we know how the fees are to be paid and handled. And they're working on that currently. Essentially, they will apply to MIDA. MIDA will hand us the permits, and then we'll process the permits to occupancy.
So I got the sense that Wasatch County wasn't moving fast enough for Mr. Barnett. I mean, he basically said when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in a development, that there has to be movement, as he put it, and that Wasatch County was holding this project back. Was that the case?
We don't believe it was the case. They met with us 4 years ago, expressing a need to get started on their hotel. We've hired additional personnel. We've added processes to our system to do it. And on processing the east side, we currently have processed 3 or 4 plats. We have construction going on in the parkway, and there is nothing going on with Extel yet. They have applied for some grading permits. So it doesn't sound like Wasatch County is the holdup, but it appears to be internal to them. We are doing everything possible to facilitate, and the properties on the east side are moving ahead at full speed. It's simply the properties on the west side that are not.
So explain to me then what the county's role is now in this control area west of Highway 40.
So on the west side, Wasatch County will be the administrator of all permits. We will have contracts in place that we provide all services. MIDA itself is a relatively small organization with only 6 or 7 people in the whole organization. So they're not designed to be operators of local government, and so we will be doing that. It's the authority to process these comes through MIDA. So for most people, they will not know any difference. There are county roads on the west side that the county will still take care of. There are also private roads that Extel will be handling on its own, just like they would in any other development. So it's just that the permitting will go through MIDA. County will be doing all the inspections, building inspections, health department, all that falls through the county. So I'm not sure that the public as a whole will see much difference. I think the concern on the part of Extel was that the county's processes were perhaps too slow for approvals. We don't believe that's the case, but the approval process is pretty well set, so I'm not sure that it's going to be too different one way or the other. But MIDA will be handling all the approvals.
Well, I think what residents are concerned about is that they feel like they may have lost their representation. We've got now, like I mentioned in the introduction, an appointed board an hour or so drive away in Kaysville. So if anybody had any concerns about the development, I mean, who do they take it to, the county council or to MIDA?
Yeah, it will have to go to MIDA, and we have this similar concerns. We are supposed to have an elected official on that board. It hasn't happened yet. That actually is a requirement of the MIDA statute. We have picked Councilman Good, Danny Good, to be that person, but it's an appointment from the governor. It hasn't happened yet. In addition, the parcel of property that is supposed to be given to MIDA on the west side has not been donated yet, and that was another requirement of all the agreements. So There's still a few things that have to happen. I think as far as the rest of the public's in that area, it will be more difficult for them to have representation for those issues. There still will be representation on a broader local government side. Our council members still represent the area. There are still local laws that have to be administered through the county that apply to that area. But essentially, the land use issues are being given to MIDA, and that is in Kaysville.
So, I mean, I guess it's easy for elected officials to say, well, you don't like it, don't talk to us, not our fault.
You know, and that's a concern, certainly, that we have. We are, all of the Development Review Committee meetings, the DRC meetings, are being held up in the Jordan now. They just had one on Monday, I believe. They're held up at the State Park building there at Jordanelle. And so we do have a lot of the action happening in the Jordanelle area, trying to keep it right in that area. The county does have representation on the Development Review Committee. The fire chief, our planning director, and some others are on there. So there is a lot of direction there. I think a lot of input can be given at those meetings. And it has been in the past. I've attended a lot of the meetings in Kaysville, and I have seen residents come up to those meetings to express concerns. So there are concerns being expressed. It is out of the area, though, and that is a concern to us as well. I think as things build out, that will switch more, that we will have more of the activity and more of the approval activity happening right in Wasatch County.
All right. Any word on a Mayflower Mountain operating agreement with Deer Valley? Of course, we know that Deer Valley, the property changed hands, but that was almost 2 years ago.
You know, I have not heard a word on that, and we certainly have a concern. A lot of what we had planned for the last 10 years up in that area is very tied to the Deer Valley Resort itself and the operating parameters that Deer Valley has instilled in the area. We kind of hitched our horse to that post because we felt that Deer Valley represented a world-class venue for skiing and other opportunity, outdoor opportunity. And so we're very interested to make sure that those agreements are facilitated quickly and basically comply with what's been happening in the past. There has been some leadership change in Deer Valley, so we don't have quite as much interaction with them, but we still work with Steve Isowitz closely, and he is on our planning board for the Jordanelle Specially Planned Area. So we are trying to keep close to that, but I've not heard that agreement is done at this point.
Yeah, I guess if this project should not be associated with Deer Valley Resort, would Wasatch County have given the approvals it did?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure how to answer that. I guess that is a possibility, and that would be a concern to us. We really do want Deer Valley involved in this. They know how to run a ski resort and do a good job with it. And we've kind of, like I say, we've kind of counted on that for the development of that area as a destination. So if it doesn't happen, that would be something we'd have to look at.
And again, the tax increment financing, that was developed for this MIDA area. All of that is now going towards building the Jordanelle Parkway, now under construction?
It is still complying with the parameters that were set forth by the county back in 2016. We developed a capital improvement plan. It is still complying with that. So the parkway is part of it. The portals are part of it. There's trails, bike trails that go with that, stormwater parking, public parking, as well as the public ski portions, the ski lifts, snowmaking. All of those are the same. They haven't changed. And that tax increment will be used to facilitate the construction of those.
So the taxes are being just pulled from the property tax at this point on just the open spaces, because that's really all we've got there now, huh?
Well, it really isn't. The increment is based upon the change in value from the issuance of building permit to occupation. So since nothing's been built yet, we're really not producing any increment at this point. There's a baseline tax value that's still there. And so that increment won't start to collect until there are actually hotels and buildings and homes being built. Those are starting soon. We have construction activity on the east side that will be happening this year and this construction year. And so we will start seeing that increment come in. It is a 25-year commitment, and so it takes some time. MIDA may bond on the availability of those funds to help that. The county's not involved in any bonding on those types of things. So we'll have to see how that increment comes in, but it will be based upon what they build. So if they don't build anything, we won't have any increment.
Yeah, it's estimated to raise how much every year? Any idea?
I think the total is going to be $200 to $250 million over the 25 years in increment.
Wow. And again, that Jordanelle Parkway is under construction, or I guess just a little hampered by the weather?
It has been delayed. We had a hard winter, and now it's a very wet spring, and so it is slowing that down. It is anticipated it will be completed sometime late fall this year.
Okay. Wasatch County School District last week announced plans to build a new high school, again, if a bond is approved. Apparently, smack dab in the area where Wasatch County trying to build the Western Bypass. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think they're respecting our what we've laid out. We shouldn't have any trouble with the bypass alignment. There are some concerns of some wetlands in the area. If there needs to be delineation of the wetlands, that could be somewhat problematic. But I think for the most part, we're going to miss it. They'll be close to each other, and they are working with us. We work closely with the school district and with Heber City on this issue, and we're currently with the approvals that we've had recently with UDOT and the Transportation Commission. They're starting into the environmental studies right now to see if the corridors that have been identified will facilitate the road. And so it'll take, 2 to 3 years probably for those environmental studies to be completed. But currently they should miss the proposed high school. So we should be okay.
Okay. Hey, anything else you wanted to mention, Mike?
No, we're thankful to be working with you. We appreciate you getting our message out, and we hope everybody's safe for the Memorial Day weekend.
Okay, Mike Davis, always thanks for your time.
You bet.
Well, the 2019 legislative session seemed to be a good one for education in Utah. In the studio to talk to us about her take on that, as well as what still needs to be done moving forward, I have the president of the Utah Education Association and a Park City resident, Heidi Matthews. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the Utah legislature funded public education by almost $5.6 billion, I think I read, for fiscal year 2020. Growth was funded. The WPU increased by 4%. The TSSA, that's the Teacher and Student Success Act Fund, approaching $100 million. Did the Education Association get what it wanted?
You know, we were really pleased with the overall outcome of the legislative session, especially given the existing resources that were there. The education fared very well in the session, that's for sure.
Yeah. Any place you think the legislature fell short?
So, you know, we exist as the Utah Education Association to assure that all of our students have what they need to be successful and have that promise of public education. And so we kind of look through three lenses. One, what are the working conditions of our educators, because those are the learning conditions of our students. We look through the lens of elevating our profession and through kind of being that last line of social justice and equity for our students, of making sure that all students have equal opportunity or equitable opportunities and equitable outcomes as well. So, yes, there's always going to be room for improvement when you have that lofty of a goal. I think one of the areas that we were, again, very pleased with is the direction that we're going with overall funding. I think we see that has allowed for a number of districts to make some promising steps in salary increases, particularly on the front end of attracting people into the profession. We see a number of districts in the Valley with starting salaries approaching $50,000, some over, which is great progress, but still looking for ways that we can make teaching a sustainable career, and that means investing along the continuum of salary and not just in those earlier years. We saw some great advancements for enticing people into the profession with the transfer of the TH Bell loan forgiveness program, which was for educators entering into the classroom. It was a kind of a conditional loan forgiveness program that impacted, I believe there were about 200 T.H. Bell scholarships per year. That was transformed into a scholarship program, which we see evidence that that is more attractive to potential future educators to get them into the classroom. There was a really great investment in mental health supports, the health and well-being of our students, with the investment of about $30 million in mental health supports with Representative Elison's bill. That is to go for counselors, social workers, again, supporting our students. I think it was worked out to be about a 0.5, a half-time professional at each school in the state. So that was definitely promising. We were very disappointed that House Bill 198, which was school grading accountability, was not heard in the Senate, as it passed almost unanimously in the House. And that was to eliminate the really blaming and shaming process of putting a single letter grade on a school. And that is especially concerning this year, as we've had so many problems with our standardized testing, with the RISE format. So really look to getting that changed sooner than later.
Yeah, you've touched on a number of issues that I'd like to hit on, but so let's start here. The teacher shortages. I mean, so we've got more money to pay teachers better. Is it really a lack of money, or is it just how much now teachers are being asked to do? I mean, it's gone so far beyond just the reading, writing, and arithmetic.
So, yeah, you absolutely hit the nail on the head. Teachers are being asked to do so much more than they have in the past. And it's taking its toll. You know, we see teachers across the country standing up and saying, hey, you know, it's not just the salaries, but it's what we have available for our students. We are not giving them what they need to be successful. And that's having to do with class sizes, that for our students to be able to be known. You know, what is best for our students? Are we looking at schools and saying, hey, this is what we know they need? We know that they need an excellent teacher who is prepared on day one and not learning on the job. We know that they need supports for learning disabilities and to kind of level that playing field for all the needs that they're coming with. And we know that they need a rich curriculum. And are we giving those resources? Are we allotting enough resources and investing that to make that happen? And I think you'll see with the census data that recently came out that we're the lowest per pupil funding in the nation again. And so while those conditions are certainly part of the reason that people are leaving the classroom and not entering it in the first place, it really does come down the resources to be able to affect change in those areas.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, that Census Bureau data, I haven't had a chance to really dig into it, but I mean, when we hear that Utah is last, we also know that Utah has more kids than any other state that we have in the public education system. So, I mean, we can't possibly be at the top given the number of kids that we have to educate. I mean, it would bankrupt the state, right?
Oh, I agree. And there are certainly circumstances that add into that. But when we are continually seeing that that our investment in public education doesn't even move us ahead of, you know, our neighboring state of Idaho, I think we have to pause and say, okay, where are we not fulfilling our promise to the students in the state? And we clearly love children in the state of Utah. We have many of them, but that does increase our obligation to be able to fulfill that promise of public education. And you know, looking at some of the census data, it shows that we have the lowest investment in instruction. We're among the lowest in salaries. But what that means is that not only are our educators making some of the lowest salaries, but they also have fewer people per student in their schools, fewer adults being paid to work with our and invest in our students.
What else did you find in that data that you thought was interesting?
Looking at where we fall with investment in our capital resources, our buildings and transportations, we're very middle of the pack in that. So we do provide those nicer facilities. I thought it was interesting that there's often people who say, "Oh, there's so much investment on our administrative end, and if we just, you know, didn't pay them as much, we would have so much more for our teachers and our other educators in the school." But actually, our investment in our administrators is fourth from the bottom as well.
Lawmakers meeting in interim meetings these months to discuss the tax restructure that didn't go anywhere in this session. They do hope to restructure the tax later on in a special session later this year. What are UEA's concerns about restructuring the tax?
Well, during the legislative session when House Bill 441 came out with, you know, 6 days left in the session, we were very concerned. It was a dramatic overhaul that would have taken $300 million, I believe, from public education. And we are looking to uphold those same ideals going into this tax restructure. You know, that at issue is what people are saying is an imbalance. And by constitution, income taxes go to public education. And that should mean that all of the income taxes go to public education. But there's been some ability since 1996 with the addition of higher ed to be kind of shift those things around. And so going into this tax restructure, we are looking to ensure that that any tax restructure must include ongoing and significant investments in public education. It must give resources to address our student needs that are growing, and it must give adequate resources to be able to address this teacher shortage and make education a sustainable career.
So the I guess you don't mind, as long as you know that there is some commitment and guarantee that education continues to get what it's got if the amendment were to be changed?
So I'm not sure that I would go that far. You know, we're having a lot of conversations about what does that mean? If this is a constitutional guarantee, it's not just about earmarking those funds for a public education. It's about the principle, the underlying principle that we believe so strongly in investing in public education in perpetuity, that we make it a constitutional mandate about these funds. What does that mean to remove it in terms of the marching orders to our legislature to make it a priority?
Okay. I wanted to just touch on this, too, with several reports about the failure of the RISE test happening. Any idea why the state went with them in the first place? SAGE wasn't doing it for us?
We had a lot of issues with SAGE, I'm sorry. And I think it just comes back to the overemphasis that we have on testing and, what we are expecting this testing to accomplish. Yes, we have to do it for the federal mandates, but do we have to be making high-stakes decisions based on it? It's very flawed because, of course, we don't. The platform should have worked. There were assurances given there, but as the Utah Education Association, what we are just looking forward to assuring is that no teacher, no student, no school will be held accountable for test results that are not reliable.
Yeah, and I'm sure you've heard from teachers who just want to do their jobs, and now they've got to deal with malfunctioning technology. Again, one more thing on their plate.
One more thing that leads to, again, the potential of a grading of a school and then, you know, blaming and shaming that school rather than getting them the resources that they need to be successful.
It was interesting to read that a former Park City School District teacher, Renee Pinckney, now your vice president.
She begins her term in the middle of June. Middle of July. I'm very excited to be working alongside of Renee. It's pretty awesome to have two of us from Park City.
It is. So how did that work?
Well, our current vice president, Roger Donahoe, decided there had a number of circumstances that had him withdrawing his candidacy really the day before our elections opened. And so I think it was a little bit of a surprise, but a welcome surprise for Renee. She was kind of putting herself out there and exploring it. So very much looking forward to her. She's extremely qualified and driven and it'll be okay. Be awesome.
We'll bring her in next time. Hey,
Heidi, it'd be great. Thank you.
Well, social media blew up as the snow started to melt from our lawns and people saw either lines of dead grass or large linear bumps in their yards. There were requests for recommendations about what to do as well as suggestions of what not to do, even offers of bringing over family pets that would go off the varmints. In the studio with me, I have Dan Stead. He owns Nature's Balance Pest Control, and he's here to give us his recommendations about what to do and what not to do. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you had told us that the vole problem is as bad as you've seen it in the last decade. Any ideas why?
You know, that's a great question. Everyone asks us that. And even the biologists struggle to know exactly why that happens. But they tell us it's due to a couple of factors: their food supply, their natural predators, the climate, as well as stress, depending on what kind of stress they're under. And they breed so quickly and so prolifically that from year to year, their populations will spike about every 3 to 5 years.
So do we know what we're seeing is voles, or are they potguts or rabbits or some other thing that burrows underground?
Great question. There's actually a few different things that people see and actually get confused and think they're all voles. Voles typically are going to be burrowing animals where they'll dig a small hole about the size of a golf ball, where a pocket gopher leaves a raised trail of soil on top of the surface, where voles are going to be burrowing below the surface and make a trail in the grass. So there's a difference, and they are treated completely different.
Okay, so the voles, you know you have voles if you see like lines of dead grass through your yard?
Correct.
Why is it that we would see that happen in somebody's yard and not right next door? I think that's just crazy.
There's a variety of different reasons for that. Some of our neighbors have pets. Terriers are voracious hunters of voles. Cats also, that's their natural prey. So people who have pets typically don't have the problem that people that don't have pets do. Also, the soil conditions make a big difference. So if the soil is wet or moist, there's lots of green vegetation, that's a very attractive place for voles to come.
Okay, I know what a potgut looks like. I don't know what a vole looks like. I don't know that I don't want to know, but what's this? Can you kind of describe
sure.
A vole?
The vole is a relative, a distant cousin of a mouse. It has a short tail instead of a long tail. It's much larger than a mouse, and it's typically brown or dark gray, and they become much larger as the season progresses. So generally in the spring, after they've been feeding all winter long, they're quite plump.
All right, and that's why we don't see them, because they're busy while the snow's on top of the ground. They're pretty safe. Feeling,
absolutely.
I guess, huh?
They don't hibernate. They breed year-round, and that's one of the problems with voles is that they're such voracious breeders that two adults can have over 40 offspring in a single year, and the adults can breed again when they're only 30 days old. So a small population can become a large population in a hurry.
All right. So what do people need to do about them? I mean, I know that pets, I guess, are kind of nature's way. But are there other safe ways?
There are. There's habitat modifications. So one of the things that we suggest that people do in the fall especially is to try to keep their lawn and their perimeter cut back fairly short. Voles are looking for harborage in tall grass. So if they keep their lawn short around the perimeter, it will help reduce the population coming towards their property, because they don't like to be out in the open. The other thing is they can create a barrier with rock or with mulch. Voles like grass. They're only vegetarian. They only eat roots. And so if they've got to dig through grass or dig through mulch or through rock, they don't like doing that. There are repellents that are available. Repellents can be helpful, but they don't last very long. So that can become an expensive proposition, and you have to continually reapply those. So those are all natural ways of dealing with it. There's also some plants that you can plant. There's a few flowers, marigolds, salvia, daffodils, and a trout lily are all plants that emit an odor that voles typically don't like. So those are some things.
And I guess there are people then that just ask you to come in and exterminate them as well?
So there are.
What happens with that?
When the population gets to be unmanageable, which can happen quickly, people ask us to come and eradicate or eliminate or reduce the population. So we do that with bait and bait boxes, and we bait the burrows with specific bait that is toxic to the voles, but it's under the ground, so it doesn't present a threat to children or pets.
Okay, so that can be done safely.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So where do they go in the summer then?
Generally in the summer, they're going to be out in the tall grasses. Mm. They'll find harborage in other places that are not populated, that are free from predators. So again, their primary predators are foxes, owls, hawks, and cats. And so they're going to go places where those animals aren't and try to hide and survive throughout the summer.
Okay. Does it matter if you aerate your lawn? I mean, is that going to make them more? I mean, are they going to show up more because it's easier to get around?
You know, it's kind of a double-edged sword there. We want to aerate our grass to make sure that it has enough air and moisture. At the same time, that it can be a very helpful thing to eradicate the lawn from voles. They don't want to be in a place where there's been a traffic going on. But at the same time, it does make the lawn more pliable, easier for them to dig in. So it does have a little bit of a double-edged sword to it.
Okay. Real quick, while I've got you here, rabbits. It just seems like we've got lots of them as well. In fact, we even have some on the Lost and Found. But people think that they're domestic, but I've got one in my yard, too.
Sure. There are domestic rabbits that have escaped, but more than likely they're wild. And rabbits are another animal that breeds very quickly, as we all know. And so we have to rely on natural predators or trapping to reduce that population.
Okay. Dogs and cats go after rabbits?
Cats not so much, but certain dogs will, yes.
Okay. Anything else you think people ought to know?
Well, I think it's important to know they do have options. People have a variety of ways you can approach this, depending on how bad the problem is. We're in the business of helping provide information as well as services for people who have this problem.
Okay, Dan, appreciate you coming by.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, the American Legion Post 14 here in the Park City area, once again planning this year's Memorial Day service in the Park City Cemetery. In the studio to tell me more about that, I have got a member of the Post, Meredith Reed. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us what's happening.
So as you mentioned, Leslie, every Memorial Day, the American Legion hosts a Memorial Day service over at the Park City Cemetery. This year, like every year, I believe it's starting at 9 a.m., and we're partnering with the Park City Museum like we did last year. So there's actually two services, a pair. So from 9 to 10, we'll be at the cemetery. And then at 10 o'clock over at Squatters, there's a follow-on service for folks who want to attend where there will be an unveiling of the plaque commemorating the B-18 crash that happened on Iron Mountain in 1941. So it's a bit of a part two to last year's service that we had, where we really went in depth on that event. And so we do have some of the family members who are the survivors from that crew. So we have four direct family members. We have lots of grandchildren, nieces, nephews coming in for the ceremony. We have folks from Minnesota, Louisiana, Texas, Idaho, California, of course, Utah as well, who are coming in to participate.
Okay. So at the cemetery itself, you've got some speakers, some music.
Yes. So we have the Troublemakers. We're so grateful for their participation. They come in and sing for us. We have the Summit County Sheriff's Office has a bagpiper and a bugler to play taps. And we also have Brigadier General Doug Cherry, who's a local Park City resident. He's the commander of the 76th Division of the U.S. Army Reserves. So he's going to give the Memorial Day address.
Okay. And it happens rain or shine.
It does. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we can skip some of this rain that we've been having in the morning. But bring an umbrella just in case. We will be standing outside in the cemetery. And we will also be having a flyover from the Utah Commemorative Air Force again this year, which is a really nice element to the service. They're historic airplanes that I don't know exactly which airframe, but they're really cool to see.
Okay. So over. Plenty of parking in the cemetery itself? Is that what?
Yeah, we do encourage people to park over at the bank on the corner. Is it the Chase Bank? I'm not sure exactly which one. The bank near the cemetery or across the street and around where the Kimball Art Center is and that corner also, because there is a road up into the cemetery, but it gets pretty crowded, so.
Wells Fargo is what I think you're
Wells
thinking
Fargo,
of.
Okay. Yes, thank
okay.
you.
Yeah, they'll be closed anyway. So
right.
And then tell me a little bit about the American Legion Post. I mean, this is what is it that you guys do?
Oh, we're here to support the veteran community here in Park City, and it's mainly our focus is Memorial Day and Veterans Day. Happy to do more if our members want to do more. But we definitely put on the service every year here. And then we also have a get-together on Veterans Day. It's usually at the No Name. And I would like to remind people, frequently those two events get conflated or switched out in their minds. But Memorial Day is the day that we remember those who died in service to our nation. Saying something like Happy Memorial Day is really not appropriate. Veterans Day is when we honor those who served our country. So,
okay. And then your service. I mean, what did you do?
I served in the United States Air Force Reserves as a chaplain.
Okay.
Yes.
Active duty or just reserves?
So I was an IMA, an individual mobilization augmentee. And it's a reservist, but when I went, I wasn't, 2 weeks a month, 2 weeks a year, every other month. With a reserve unit, I worked as with active duty folks. So I was kind of a come in off the bench for active duty. So it was an interesting way to, it was sort of a free agent.
Yeah. So when they went on vacation or something that they'd need a chaplain to step
or
in.
Or when people deployed or any number of things, if they just needed some extra support, they could call me and I'd say, sure, I'll come help.
So, okay. Well, thanks for your service.
Yeah. Thanks.
Anything else you want to add?
No, just that I appreciate, I wanted to specifically say, Steve Latham, David Nicholas, and Sandra Morrison from the Park City Museum have been great partners, and we really appreciate working with them to make this a great event for everybody.
Okay, Meredith, thank you.